And welcome to Here We Stand. I'm your host, Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice, back live. Believe it or not, we're back live after about 5-6 weeks playing reruns. I hope you're able to endure that. Hope it wasn't too confusing for you. We're here every Sunday now live, 6 p.m. Eastern Time. And that song, of course, is one of our favorites. I think it's considered one of our theme songs now. For all the thrones have fallen, we're not just talking the Vatican and the Crown of England, but all these false thrones are overthrown as the people everywhere are waking up all over this wonderful world of ours. And today is really coming up on the fifth anniversary of this program. We started in 2015, the same month, January 2015, that the Republic of Canada was formed in Winnipeg, 221 delegates declaring sovereignty from the Crown of England and its false jurisdiction. In those 5 years, a lot has been going on. One of the people who are going to be with us today, actually my co-host and guest, Brenda Everill, was with me, along with me and three other people, were candidates in the recent Canadian federal election from Picton, Ontario, not to be elected into the false and treasonous Parliament of Canada, but as delegates to a future Congress of a Republic of Canada. And she's also organizing with the Republic of Ontario. We're going to have Brenda on in just a moment, but a couple of announcements first. For those who have been wondering what the hell's going on over the last week and what happened to Kevin, we have been organizing a number of things that are going to start manifesting in January. There's, as you may have noticed in the notice that's up on our site, murderbydecree.com, under ITCCS updates, there are no new training schools forming under the jurisdiction of the Republic in Vancouver, Winnipeg, and Toronto, training people in common law and to assume sheriff positions and convener of Republican Assembly positions within the new Republic. Those are going to be going on starting the middle of the month, starting January 15th, the anniversary of the proclamation of the Republic. Also, January 23rd, there's a press conference I'll be holding about upcoming actions related to where we go from here in terms of stopping these crimes of genocide. Upcoming shows are going to feature people of the Chilcotin Nation on the west coast of Canada talking about how they are being exterminated today. Their attempts to declare sovereignty are being met with attacks, imprisonments, and other things. We're going to be hearing about that as part of the West Coast grand jury that's been investigating these crimes against the innocent that are ongoing today. You can also follow our work regularly by going to murderbydecree.com. And here's three concrete things you can do. You join the Republic, write to republicofcanada@gmail.com. You get a complete information package, including citizenship cards, how to declare local sovereignty and form a local assembly. You can sustain this program. It costs us $280 a month to do this broadcast. Send a donation. Just write to thecommonland@gmail.com to donate. And also book yours truly in for speaking gigs. Buy my books on Amazon. Keep the flag flying, people. So let me bring Brenda on. Hello, Brenda. How are you?
I'm all right, Kev. How are you doing? Happy New Year.
Well, Happy New Year to you. You know, it's going to be a good one. And it's interesting that, you know, we had this slight delay. Oh, I think we started the show 4 or 5 minutes because for the first time in history, Don, my operator, tried calling me at the number I was at, and he couldn't get through. And so I had to call in. And it's an example of the kind of opposition and shutdown we're facing in this work, you know. I know you have a personal taste of that all the time, that kind of opposition.
Oh, for sure, yes. I'm always being blocked from connecting with people and getting to where I need to be, and just everyday troubles in the way of trying to cope with this system and overcome it. There's many barriers, but we just find new ways to overcome them and keep moving forward.
Yeah, no, I know. I wanted to kick off. I found this fantastic quote from Frederick Douglass I want to share. It kind of sums up where we're at these days. He was a slave who led the abolitionist movement in America. He recruited black soldiers for the Union Army during the Civil War and that. And here's this great quote. If there is no struggle, there's no progress. Those who say they favor freedom and yet are against agitation are like those who want to plant crops without plowing the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has and then never will. Find out just what people will submit to, and you found the exact amount of injustice and wrong which will be imposed on them. And those wrongs will continue until they are resisted with either words or blows or both. The limits of tyrant, and here's a great line, the limits of tyrants are prescribed by the endurance of those whom they oppress, right?
True, and I believe our endurance is running out for that nonsense. So,
well, let's talk about that. You know, when we were talking this week, Brenda, you reminded me about, you know, the need to look at the things we've achieved. And I know that, you know, my story is well known to a lot of people, but yours isn't. And I want you to have the chance to be able to describe how you started a real shitstorm going in Belleville and Picton about the Children's Aid Society, how they were trafficking children. And it's one of the reasons I asked to run in the last election, so you could use that as a platform to talk about how you've been able to achieve things on the ground. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that, because I know we've got a lot of new listeners who may not know your story.
There's two parts of the story. I look at it pre-2005 and post-2005. I had originally been involved with CAS in 2000, the Children's Aid Society. And in that year, the laws had changed so that they could apprehend on the fear of parents doing something. So a parent didn't actually have to do anything. And many children were at risk of being apprehended at that time, and a lot were. And I was one of those families. And throughout that era, I was being locked up in the psych ward, and I really didn't know what was going on in my life. It was a very confusing time. And that doctor that would continued to lock me up in the psych ward for pushing back against problems that I was experiencing in my life, he actually was a doctor here in Belleville. He formed the psychiatric unit at Belleville General Hospital, and his name was Dr. Kahn. And I'd urge people to look into his history. The Prince Edward County CAS adopted a boy to him, and they named him Ty Kahn. And Ty ended up going through the judicial system, and he broke out of prisons, and he eventually was... He died in Toronto, surrounded by police. There's controversy whether he killed himself or the police did it, whatnot. But there's a book called Who Killed Ty Kahn, written by Lyndon McIntyre from the Fifth Estate. And so there's connections there. And then we move on to 2005, and I became aware that children were being sexually assaulted in foster care. So I already had my issues with the CAS, but I had my children back in my care, and I kept advocating. And it took me from 05 till about 2011 to break the story open. Somehow, just magically, the stars aligned, and the media started reporting that foster parents were being arrested. And so then, 2 years ago, I believe, out of the blue again, they announced that OPP had charged the former executive director, William Sweet, with neglecting or failing to care for the children under his direction. So that is being heavily controlled right now. That whole narrative, it's difficult to get information about his court date and what goes on in court. But Global News has recently, over the last year, picked up the story again. And they seem to be gatekeeping the issue because I told
right.
them that, you know, I tried to blow that whistle for many years, and a whole community of professionals colluded against me, set me up for false charges and imprisonment, and targeted my own children again for apprehension and made their lives very complicated and miserable.
If I could just jump in for a minute, this is really important because so much of our struggle isn't even about the crime itself, which has been documented, everybody knows it's going on. It's how they respond when we bring it out is we get targeted. And the cover-up is as serious as a crime as the original act. And, you know, this is our focus now, pulling this back, because as you said yourself, and you're constantly saying this on the show, you've had the experience time again, the system doesn't work, and we can't get justice in it, right?
No. And I'm starting to be able to produce that evidence because I went and did reports and I sent it to the RCMP, the OPP, the Crown Attorney, the Attorney General, My MPP, who I had been dealing with throughout trying to expose the rapes in foster care, and I faxed it. I have the fax proof that I'm telling them that a network of people were responsible for everything that was going on with these children being raped, and that it was not just the executive director. It couldn't possibly just be one man. And that I have the evidence because my family was targeted and persecuted all through my efforts. So collectively, everyone that I sent that fax to has decided not to respond to me, which I anticipated. So now I have to put them on some sort of notice and push the issue a little further. Not that I have faith that any of them will do the right thing. I just have to keep pushing this matter through to the end to prove that there is absolutely no justice in Canada when it comes to human trafficking.
Okay, so this is kind of the nub of the whole question, because as we've experienced on so many different issues, you can keep pushing until you're blue in the face. Under the present jurisdiction structure, there's not going to be changed because they're not allowed to. They're controlled by this crown system, which is criminal in its own nature. So, you know, it's
exactly.
Like asking the Mafia Don for justice.
That never ends.
Pardon me?
It's the song that never ends, and society
right.
Keeps singing it. Like,
okay.
Enough
so the
enough.
Alternative, you know, the people have, and it's hard for people to imagine something different. We always tend to go back to what exists to say, let's try to get justice out of it, but it doesn't work. So when we're talking about a new jurisdiction, this is the whole point of the Republic of Canada, that we can legally do this. We proved in when we brought down the Pope, which is, you know, the 7th anniversary is coming up of the guy's, Ratzinger's resignation. It happened because of a common law court action. That has an effect. So let's talk a little bit about what that might look like in this case, right?
Well, if, you know, I can keep exposure on this case and get some support with helping to keep that light shining, because I'm just one person, my technology skills are really limited. I have severe limitations right now, so anyone who can be digging for information about Bill Sweet and perhaps even Masonic connections, because we have evidence that a lot of judges that are concealing this pedophilia and human trafficking are part of the Masonic network. So just that kind of networking, if people interested in the case could network with me and send me news and updates or things that they're aware of, and we'll just keep putting the pressure on it, and then we'll use this model to show, you know, how to shut other CASs down, and because that has to happen. I mean, they're the biggest human traffickers in Canada, and it's being funded by tax dollars, and we have to start protecting all of our children again at community levels.
Well, let's talk about how we do that. Some ideas about that. I mean, we've talked about, and people are already doing this. You know, the block watch system is already in effect. You can join the block watch and help monitor your neighborhood. Well, here's an idea somebody at West had. Look, as people believe in a republic and no more crown jurisdiction, let's join these block watch committees, form them as a local community militia, if you like, and we protect our children and do what the police refuse to do. I mean, that's kind of one example, right?
Exactly. And, you know, if we could, I believe the last time I checked into it, a membership at my local CAS was $5. So, you know, if we all got on the boards and eventually took them over, and while, you know, we're building our own things, the more we can do to infiltrate them as they've infiltrated us, the better. Because they have to be brought down. They are harming our children. All the evidence is out there. You can Google,
yep.
And you could fall down that rabbit hole and be in it for years to come. The child protection system is a nightmare. And
later in the show, I do want to get into some specifics about what we might do, you know, in the area you are. But when we were talking before, you mentioned that you've learned some real lessons out of this thing. I mean, the need to be self-reliant and not be afraid, right? They need to document everything really well and keep the spotlight on them like you're talking about. Do you want to talk about maybe some of the things you did learn on the ground about what to do and not?
Well, that was the benefit of going through it the first time, you know, having my children apprehended in 2000. I got a taste of the system and how it operated. And just always being on the outside looking in type of person, I immediately see all the flaws. So I did some mild advocacy for my community and through at Ontario sometimes, you know, just trying to help families become aware of the issues. And so then when it hit me again in 2005, when they started building a case against me again, I could literally see everything that was coming because I'd experienced it before. So if, you know, people who are afraid of losing their kids, if they do fight back, if they just go on and see what other parents are saying about how the system works and they're prepared for that, you can read them like a book. Like, they're operating out of a book. And a lot of these people aren't bad. They're just being controlled by that book, by the system and the way it operates. So, like, just like us, if they step out of line, they're canned and they don't have a job and all that kind of stuff. So I've learned that not everybody's a bad person. And if you're, you know, you can hold yourself together, you actually find a few earth angels while you're going through the hell and they'll help you. There's, you know, somebody behind the counter at the courthouse. If you're kind and patient, they'll give you a wink and they'll slip you a little bone and, you know. But the more angry you are, you alienate, I found this out the hard way, you alienate all that help away from you.
Right. So, now, that's the thing, too, I found with cops. So, the one thing you find, is, even with Mounties, is that they're sympathetic to the idea that, like, the Crown has no more authority. They're willing to join up with something else, but they got to see something else working, right?
Exactly.
That's part of the problem.
Well, you know, everybody has their life on the line here. They have families and mortgages and loans, and they can't imagine just walking out of the system and then wondering what to do. They do have to have some concrete evidence that they're going to be okay if they do leave that system.
Yeah, it's funny. Even though two-thirds of Canadians want a republic, nobody seems to be willing to act on it. They're all kind of waiting for somebody else. And that's something I want to talk to you about, because we're going to play a clip in a minute, and it has to do about language, because language is the way we're controlled. You know, this term, we're talking about this, Brenda, the term accountability. You hear that a lot. And the system says, oh, there has to be accountability. But what they mean by that word is how they manage the fallout when their own shit comes out. When they talk about accountability, they mean they move in, they spin the narrative so that nobody else is implicated, and they manage the whole thing so that, you know, none of this stuff will come out. And we have to really be aware of these words. Even the word genocide, right? I mean, this is what this clip is talking about. It's a little thing I gave, I wrote for the Globe and Mail, which they never printed, believe it or not. But it had to do when Trudeau, last June 4th, said, yes, genocide has happened in Canada. Now, for them to use that word means they think it's safe now. There won't be any legal fallout for them to do it. But I want to just play this clip, and then I want your thoughts about this, because it has to do with the use of words and how it's controlled. If you don't mind, we're going to listen to this, and then we'll talk about it.
Sure, sounds
good. Go ahead, Don.
Hi, everyone. Kevin Annett again. It's June 13th. Well, genocide, the G word. It's suddenly in popular usage. Everybody's using it without even knowing what it means, including the Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau, who last week made the announcement that, yes, genocide did occur in Canada. Well, I've written a very personal reflection on this, and this is directed to the hearts and minds of every Canadian, especially those who are enforcing the laws and protecting this genocidal regime, the police, the RCMP, the politicians, the civil servants, the judges. This is for you, especially. I entitle it, As Long as It Takes for a Child's Body to Rot, Reflections on the G-Word in Canada. The word game. We all play it. The dirtier the mess, the more people talk around it, especially Canadians who never seem to want to offend anyone. And what's more offensive than the sight, or even the thought, of little children ripped to pieces and thrown in a ditch behind a church somewhere to decompose in the mouths of vermin? Instead, how preferable to use words that mentally tuck away the horror as deftly as a late-night shovel, tossing in the dirt with each syllable we use until the gore is safely entombed and expunged. And then, like some post-midnight cleanup squad, More words must kick in to erase the erasure that renders the truth into nothing. For that is what the tiny corpses have become, nothing. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau was not thinking of how an electrode was clamped onto the penis of 9-year-old Buster Baptiste when he spoke to the media about genocide the other day. In his effort to shift attention away from more than a century of state and church-led mass murder of Indian residential school children, with controlled references to missing women over the past 30 years, Trudeau displayed not just an astounding chicanery, but a profound ignorance of what he's talking about. Small wonder, since the pitiful screams of Native women and children have never reached his ears, nor will they. He spoke of genocide, but his stomach didn't heave in sickness from the putrid stench of weeks-old corpses unearthed and torn apart by roving res dogs. He should have vomited in horror right there in front of the TV cameras. Instead, he read from a politically correct script. Meanwhile, the flesh from those cadavers is rotting away as part of an officially kept secret, leaving only a desiccated abstraction tucked neatly between the letters G and E. Well, official lies aren't born overnight. They take years to be fashioned from dead remains. About 10 years, as a matter of fact. Actually, the same time that it takes for the flesh of an unprotected child's body lining the earth to rot away. Well, there's no coincidence there. It's been just over 10 years now since Canada's biggest lie officially began to conceal its biggest crime. It's taken that long for children's teeth yanked from their jaws without painkillers to be sanitized into the euphemism called abuse. For the features of the corpses to finally melt and bleed away into an indiscernible mush. Years of diligent phrase crafting were needed to alter the newborn baby's screech of agony into a mere allegation as his tiny body was tossed into the furnace flames by Brother Murphy. The procession of the dead boys and girls that would take more than 2 days to pass at a rate of one corpse every second required $68 million to be morphed into a column of numbers bearing a precise monetary value. Making the slime digestible is never an inexpensive effort by church or state. Genocide talk is fashionable and permissible nowadays in Canada because the word has been bled and emptied of any meaning, and not only by scheming church lawyers and drone-like politicians in Ottawa. The victims and survivors themselves have been tortured into silence and have internalized the stern command to never speak of what actually happened to them. A substitute language is provided for them by their torturers, employing terms like mistreatment to describe the taste of rotten garbage in their mouths, shoved there before a nun could see them, lest they too starve to death like all the other children on the dorm. In the words of Vera Hunt, who was the sole survivor of a group of 9 sisters and cousins interned at the United Church Alberni Residential School, quote, "You could live in their lie or you could die. Those were your only choices, and they still are. My voice is still stuck back in that hellhole, and its wings are clipped." Unquote. Well, sometimes the bird finds its wings again, but its cries are intolerable for most of us. During the years when I operated an open mic radio program in Vancouver's downtown east side, I encouraged anyone with a story to come on the air, especially if they're residential school survivors. Like my previous open pulpit policy in Port Alberni, not a lot of people took advantage of the offer at first. But one Aboriginal woman who never said her name would occasionally appear in the studio and immediately explode in a torrent of cries, sobs, and gasping accounts of what had happened to her in Alert Bay at the Anglican school there. She never fudged her words. She never tried to stem the blood of and the flood of raw terror of rape and murder that she described. She relived everything right in front of us, and she named those who had done it and who were still doing it. And then she would stumble crying from the studio. Well, the woman's volcanic authenticity infuriated everyone around me, not just the staid, pale staff members at Co-op Radio, but the other Native survivors themselves who helped me with my Hidden from History radio program. They all shrank away from the witness whenever she entered the building, and they winced or looked away angrily as her flood of horror filled the airwaves. They all demanded that I bar her from the program. When I refused, their wrath was turned onto me, as if I was the one with the problem. Eventually, even my most politically correct associates agreed that, for the sake of everyone, not only the cries of that witness, but my own voice would just have to be stilled. A microcosm of Canada, yes indeed. But the incident made me recognize my own stifled voice, of how easier it was for me then to speak about other people's suffering than my own. For what words are there to describe the agonized screams of my 5-year-old daughter Eleanor when she was torn from my arms by a church-funded divorce court order, or the cold, dead-eyed stare of the men responsible? How do we depict to others, let alone deal with, the deliberate torture that is aimed squarely and relentlessly at us? How do we deal with it? How do we describe it, especially as it shreds our hearts into little pieces? The truth is, we can't. We fight back the best we can, even in our pain. We hold on to the moments of life, even as the darkness descends. But up against the enormous odds of institutionalized crime, we can never make better what's been done. The destruction is much too great. The lies and the murders continue unabated despite all of the words. And from out of this madness and our own strangled mouths, other voices try to speak in our place. They try to speak words that distance and distract and delay the truth. And so any chance for life on what may or may not be justice boils down to the first basic and very subversive task of recovering our own voice. Not the one we think we know, but our hidden, forgotten, and murdered voice, buried alive and struggling to crawl its way out and shout a single word that can shatter and overturn the entire sick arrangement. Genocide used to be such a word in Canada. When I first used it in 1996 to describe our homegrown Christian death camps called residential schools, I was roundly condemned and mocked by pretty much everyone, especially since my use of it was always accompanied with living, bleeding examples and eyewitnesses. But I kept repeating the word and proved what it was in our own time and place, and thereby I defined the field of battle. I said mass murder whenever the press spoke of abuse, putting a human face on the crime that nobody, native or pale, wanted to look at. And so eventually those responsible for the crime knew they had to co-opt the word and strip it of any life, as efficiently as they had done without hesitation or consequence to entire nations of children. Nothing is so like God as silence, somebody once wrote. Perhaps maybe the truth is just like that, speechless in the face of human depravity and self-delusion, simply a huge set of eyes, seeing all of the dark and hidden places and knowing a truth so huge and unimaginable that it has no words to describe it. It has no language. A New Chelneth elder in Port Alberni once said to me, "We never talk about what's sacred because there aren't any words for it." Well, what's profane and evil is the same way. It has no words. Maybe in the end, that's why we all rely on the false substitutes that say nothing and change nothing. And yet, in the beginning, there was a word, unadulterated and true. That word remains, like the proverbial living stream bubbling beneath all the concrete office towers of vested interest and lies. Somehow, we each must reach down through all our fears and our doubts and extract that word and let it root and finally erupt from our mouths, knowing that it has always resided there. And then like a blast at Jericho, that voice can cause the towers to buckle and collapse, opening all of the secrets and the secret places, even in a place like Canada. For there is nothing that is hidden that will not be revealed, but only by those who find and who keep their own voice. Genocide. The word means to deliberately kill a people. To kill, not to civilize, not to assimilate, not to abuse, not to heal. To kill. So who and what are we to have done such a thing? That's a question that Canadians never ask themselves. Who or what are we to have even done this, to cover it up and to continue it? Justin Trudeau, by publicly admitting to genocide, said that we are such killers. So what is the proper sentence for premeditated murder? Should the killer himself determine his own sentence? or the terms by which his surviving victims recover? If the killer retains a spark of conscience and humanity, does he not fall to his knees in agony and sorrow, and hope not for his own recovery, but for the lives of all of the innocents he has snuffed out and slaughtered, and who continue in that torment? I see no such remorse or humanity among my people. I hear only stale and dead words, like the mumbling of lost souls who don't realize that they're dead. Can a shoot still spring from a fallen and slain tree? We shall see. Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice, murderbydecree.com. I thank you.
And we're back. That was a commentary I did last summer. First of all, Brenda, thoughts, comments, anything that was triggered by any of the stuff I said there?
First, I was triggered. A lot of that Native genocide stuff really rocks me. But it did, when you were talking about how the language is used, it immediately reminded me how they're using the terms underage women in the news instead of girls or children or even, you know, boys. They just always use this term underage man or woman, and it takes away from the term that they were actually children that were assaulted.
Right.
You know, like the news speak of war is peace and how the UN wants everyone to think peacemakers and peacekeepers are, you know, it's all in reverse. So the way that we use these words now is really important because they're strong words, but at the same time, people are becoming conditioned to them. And the media has a way to put a spin on these words so that they're really not as bad or powerful as they are. So we've just got to, you know, start really paying attention to the language that we use and the way that it's spoken and use our intuitions on what the underlying message really is in the words that are being used, because words are definitely weapons being used against us right now.
I wonder if you've had this experience. Like, I know all the times that I've sat in what they call the healing circles and that, it's so hard to get people to speak the truth about what happened to them. And it isn't just fear. They don't have their own language. They're always using somebody else's word, right? And
exactly. And I even find myself doing it sometimes. It's a really hard thing to remove yourself from.
Do you ever get the feeling that we're like...
Awareness is the first part of it. As long as, you know, we keep reminding people that about our language. And then the more conscious we become, the better we get at things. So the more we know better, the more we do better.
Right. You know, it's hard for people like us because when you know the truth and you keep saying it, you're so alone. You're totally isolated. And after a while, I mean, I was going to ask you, do you ever get the sense that you're kind of living in the land of the land of the dead? I mean, that there's a certain deadness in people that doesn't seem to come alive. You know, you tell them these things and they don't
act, felt like,
right?
I was alone in that for a long time, but I've come to realize most recently that there's so many people like you and I out there, and we all thought that we were alone.
Mm-hmm.
But the time is coming now where we're all going to connect and we're going to move these mountains.
I agree with you, sister.
It has been a dark, lonely ride for a lot of us, but that darkness showed us where the light is, and we're all standing in that light now. We've just got to connect.
So let's talk a little bit about that, how we do that. You know, there have been attempts all over pulling people together, whether it's something as ambitious as a people's assembly or even something smaller, just a group to talk about these things. I find the endurance of people is really low. That, you know, they'll come to something, they'll commit, and then they'll never show up again, or something else distracts them. Is that something you're finding in where you live?
I do. I find, you know, a lot of things factor into why people couldn't commit, but I also know that it's the age that we were in, and we're coming out of that age now where a lot of truth is becoming blatant and obvious, and there's no way for people to hide from that or to turn from that truth, so they have to deal with it. And now, you know, it's easier for people to make choices once truth becomes obvious. So I think we're going to see greater numbers of people responding to getting on board with changing the world and resisting this global agenda, because it's just the time now. It's upon us scientifically and spiritually. A lot of people are aware that we're coming into a much better age and time of truth, where the truth is obvious for us all. And what's going to define us now is who acts on that truth.
Right, and it's the acting that's key. And, you know, when we take action, the first thing, it's quite incredible, because so much of the barrier is in our own minds. And I remember when we first started occupying churches on Sundays, it felt like there was a barrier, literally, we had to push through. Somebody had to be the point of the spear and walk into the church. And then after that, everyone else's fear, they overcame it earlier because they were looking to somebody to be that tip of the spear. And the trick is, I mean, okay, those of us who act in that way, we know we're out front. How do we get the secondary support around us so we're not wiped out? Right, I know there is a power around us that doesn't allow us to be touched, and people have got different explanations about what that is. But it's building that secondary group around us that's key to enduring this, and this is why meeting regularly is so important. I mean, we talked about, well, hell, let's get the Belleville Public Library, let's start holding meetings every week, just for people to wrap, right, to talk, to figure out what we want to do locally. Is that something you think you're hoping to do, or even on... this or other issues?
I think it's the first step, you know, just to I want to try a couple different strategies, maybe do some online roundtable discussions and have library meetings, because I know some people, you know, have anxiety from everything that they've been through in this horrible, oppressive world, and it's hard for them to get to meetings, whether financially or medically or whatever. So if I, you know, could talk to them online, I'm willing to do it that way too. And I'm willing to join other groups. And, you know, I just know what I know, but I know that I know nothing in the grand scheme of everything. So I'm willing to join in on other discussions and other groups. So if people want to invite me, you know, to just come and see what they're up to, and just networking and letting, you know, everybody know that we're all here and we're all in need of goodwill and support and knowledge. And I think, you know, once humans have knowledge, they act on it. So we just have to have that knowledge now, solidify it and support each other and, you know, do it gently. There's been a lot of blame. We have to move forward with love and acceptance. And me, myself, you know, there was no way through all this nonsense I wasn't getting angry and lost. And I found my way back onto the path, and, you know, I know that anger can't direct me anymore. So if we can all start looking beyond our egos and our justified anger, and just come together, and if not for ourselves, for the sake of the future generation and these poor children that are just, you know, they're being affected by education, health, like medical tyranny, the child protection services, broken families, like the pedophilia. It's a pretty bad place for children, and it's up to us to make that better ASAP. So we're all doing that in our own ways, and we just have to support each other a little more in 2020, and I think it's all going to come together.
Okay, that's a word. And Brenda, I don't want to use you as a straight woman or anything, but I did want to mention the word you use again. Pedophilia is a programmed word. It means friend of children. So we got to replace that word. Never use it again, because it's part of the conditioning. Just call it what it is. Child rapist. He's a child rapist. He's a child killer, right? I know it takes a while to can even think in a new way, because we use this borrowed language all the time, but one of the things, and I should mention, we're planning these training schools, and I want to give a little description to people, because I've had four or five people write in. Well, the Republic's January 15th anniversary, fifth anniversary of the declaring of the Republic. What are these training schools? What do they consist of? Well, the short version is you take a Saturday and you describe the principles of common law, the Republic, and all that, but then you have role-playing sessions where somebody's a cop and they're stopping you for some reason, and you hand them your Republic of Canada citizenship card, and it says, I'm outside your jurisdiction. I don't recognize the jurisdiction. The Crown is a convicted criminal body. I'm in a common law jurisdiction. I'm not harming anybody. You have no authority over me. So how do you react in that situation? We know what the cops are going to do. The cop is either not going to know what you're talking about or will try to get heavy with you. And what do we do in those situations? We need to come together in these sessions where we see, you know, alternatives. And it's that coming together regularly. You know, I've worked with people who went through the civil rights movement in the 60s, and they said their strength back then was that they were in contact every day. They ate together. They worked together every day. They went. They got beaten up together. They had a common experience. We don't get that experience on the internet. You don't get it by sending emails to people. You get it on the ground, working in the community. So, I just want to put that out there because it's that contact and the consistency that's going to change things, right?
Certainly.
Yeah. I did want to ask you if you could, if you feel like sharing any contact info with, you know, if you want to tell folks how to reach or any of that in Belleville, Ontario, because it's one of the areas that we're going to be operating in the spring.
For a start point, my email is just brendaeverall@gmail.com, and I have internet now, so I'm just working off a little cell phone for internet stuff, and it's pretty daunting for me right now until I get a laptop. But, yeah, if anybody that wants to be in touch can email me. I'm looking to learn more information myself, to network with other people. We just got to get talking and get the show on the road here because, like I said, it's the kids who are ultimately relying on us. And we have to resist this Agenda 21 or Agenda 2030 or the globalism, whatever you refer to it as. And I'd really like any information that anyone has about this William Sweet case or the now-defunct Prince Edward County Children's Aid Society.
Right.
So, yeah, email's best for a starting point, I guess, and then we could figure out how to meet or connect further from there.
Right, good, Brenda. And, you know, I should flag, since you mentioned the Agenda 2030, you might have noticed, I don't know if folks have noticed this, there's this film that was released. It's at Global Exposure now. It's called Two Popes. And you got Anthony Hopkins and that British actor, Jonathan Pryce. And guess who they're starring as? President Pope Francis and Joe the Rat Ratzinger, okay? Benedict and Francis are sitting down like these two cool guys, and they're just, from people who've seen the film, they say it's really disgusting. It's trying to portray these child killers as wise statesmen and holy men, and it's this horrible kind of assault on what we know is true, and it's happening right now. Well, right now, it's leading up to the seventh anniversary of us forcing Ratzinger to resign in the second week in February 2013. Now, the reason they're bringing in that spin is they need that history buried once and for all. He stepped down because of a common law docket of information that the Spanish government looked at, wrote to the Secretary of State in Rome on February 6, 2013, and said Pope Benedict may face arrest if he comes to Spain because he's actively protecting child traffickers and killers, not just child rapists. And he steps down 6 days later, okay? 5 days, actually, February 11th. Which was a significant date because it was the anniversary of the founding of the Vatican Bank and the crimen solicitanus policy in 1929. So these things are not accidental, but they they're desperate to bury that memory because we demonstrated that we can force a pope out of office. And so it's part of this general assault on memory and our minds and everything that's going on. And I wanted to flag that because in the coming weeks we're going to have programs on that. We're going to have next week on this show, please tune in because we have an insider from the Mormon Church, the LDS Church in Salt Lake City, who's going to be talking about not only these crimes, the connection between the Vatican and the Mormons, but the spiritual dimensions to this, the bigger dimensions that we're dealing with. That'll be next week. Folks may not realize that in the FBI is actually investigating the Mormon Church because they're laundering up to $100 billion, if you can believe it. And that's on the scale of the Vatican Bank. So these are really important things that are blowing up now. And we have to stay on course, you know, Brenda. We've got to keep the truth and the memory alive of how these things came about. So our program here is now especially important because over the next few months we're going to be keeping these stories alive of our history that they're trying their best to bury right now.
Well, bury it in advance to this global education pact that's coming up in May, where world leaders and religious leaders are all set to go to the Vatican, and it's a global education pact, so there's too much to explain about, you know, what that holds, but, you know, the two popes, they have to make them look really good in advance to what they're going to try and pull off in May.
Well, they're both convicted criminals under international law. There's standing arrest warrants for both of them. They're active members of the Ninth Circle that ritually sacrifice and traffic and kill children. There's tons of evidence. People read it. Go to murderbydecree.com. A lot of our history and evidence of all of these crimes are right there. And Brenda, I want you to thank you for coming on. We'll do it regularly as we proceed in our work. And also, the other thing to keep in mind is that in the this whole Agenda 2030, a big foundation of that is this one world religion, which Bergoglio was pushing really hard. And it's, again, a cover. You have one world corporation that's going to organize this entire child-killing machine around the world, so it's going to increase the crime, the very existence of
even
that.
Even if you can't get on board with past corruption, you need to look into Agenda 2030 because it promises to change life as you know it.
Right. So, well, thank you, Brenda, for being
with
us.
And we're a decade away from 2030, so I suggest
everyone
familiar with the agenda.
That's right. Thanks, Brenda. We'll talk again real soon. And we're going to now our closing song, one of our favorites, The World Turned Upside Down. And this is Billy Bragg and Amanda Palmer. They were singing in America. This song is about the diggers. In 1649, a group of poor folks in England got together and began to hold the land in common and dig it. It's their story, and it shows our traditions. The common law, you know, I was standing outside looking at the sun today, and a kid rode by on his bike, and I was thinking, the earth and children, they're our natural restorers. They heal us. They teach us. We have got to defend them to the death because our lives as a people are on the line. Our backs are to the wall, people. This is not an abstract issue anymore. It could affect you tomorrow and is affecting innocent children today. So get on board with us. Follow us, murderbydecree.com. Be here every Sunday. Use us as a tool to spread the news and organize with us to reclaim our minds and our children and our world. And write to us, republicofkanata@gmail.com. Until next week, stay strong, stay clear. This is Kevin Andy, Eagle Strong Voice. I thank you.